Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Seeking Witchcraft. It's me, your host, Ashley, and today I have on Ron Patron from White Rose Witching to talk about working with queer ancestors. So welcome, Ron, to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So Ron, can you share a little bit of your journey and your background and kind of guide us into this topic that we're going to discuss today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a queer-identified Cuban-American, and I was raised Roman Catholic, but in that sort of, you know, from Florida originally, South Florida, and so was raised in that sort of superstitious Catholic milieu. I usually tell people, if you've read a lot, any like Latin American fiction, it's that literary genre of magical realism. And when I was in high school, when we were reading a bunch of it, me and my other Hispanic like peers were like, yeah, this is just like how it is. And everybody, all the non-Hispanic folks were a little bit stunned by that. And so I, even though I tell folks that I've been practicing pagan or practicing witch for about 20 years, the reality of it is that I grew up in a very sort of folk Catholic environment that incorporates a bunch of stuff that, while folks like my grandmother might not consider it to be witchcraft or anything like that, it very much is kind of a variation on a theme. So in some capacity, I've been in this sort of occult or esoteric space for pretty much all of my life. And over the last several years, I've really dove, I guess, more deeply into it. I've become an ordained pagan cleric through Sacred Well Congregation. I've really, really worked to connect with my local community, to build community, but to also just find spaces with folks who have like practices or who are like-minded folks. And specifically when it comes to the queer aspect of it, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm queer identified. I'm a gay male. And that was coming out for me was a little bit of a rough patch, especially because when I was younger, I was an altar server. I was very much involved with the church. And so my teenage years of realizing that like I was gay, and then also this was in the 90s. And so kind of reconciling, you know, that with the messaging you're getting from the church and just from society in general was very kind of jarring. And it created this sort of like spiritual fissure that I really left kind of practicing or being involved in anything that was could be considered sort of spiritual or religious in general for a long time. And it's only in the last, I would say, maybe 7 or 8 years that even within my pagan practices and my witchcraft that I've circled back to really trying to figure out how to reconcile that and bring my identity into those practices and make those practices queer affirming, not just for me, but just also for the community that I find myself in. And a lot of the way that I do that is through, a lot of the way that I found that really resonates for me and for other folks is through queer ancestor work, whether that's through like queer ancestor veneration or queer ancestor sort of remembrance. It can take on a bunch of different, it can show up a bunch of different ways.
Awesome. So thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I have to say your point about growing up in a Catholic background, like I definitely resonated with that because same. I share that Catholic trauma. Not saying you have Catholic trauma, but I share that Catholicism background, especially Hispanic Catholicism background. And I think of things that Catholics wouldn't necessarily say are witchcraft or magical in any form, but then you have things like you take a little statue of Saint Joseph and you bury him in your yard to sell a house, yep. And then you unbury him or whatever. And I'm like, there's some magic to that. There's something there.
Yeah, and my honestly, like, it's hilarious that that's the example you go to, because my mom was a realtor while I was in high school and college, and she legit drove around with, like, in the glove compartment of her truck, she had a bunch of tiny Saint Joseph statues that she could bury at the houses that she was trying to sell.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's funny, like, this made me think about, and I don't mean to veer us off topic, but just relating to what you were saying, my mom has told me in the past that she's had different ESP type things where, I don't know, just strange coincidences of little psychic events. And she was like, yeah, I thought it was a gift from Jesus. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who is Christian, but they're very sort of progressive liberal Christian. They are queer identified and they're pursuing a seminary program out in Michigan. And a couple of years ago, when we first connected via Twitter, like during like the height of COVID, when everybody was really on lockdown, and in a conversation we were having, I referred to growing up in a sort of Hispanic Catholic household and our relationship to Catholicism and the saints and all that sort of stuff as like the saints being like a pantheon. And it really is, if you look at it, they're sort of like demigods or these sort of subset of deities. And my, you know, if you go into my grandparents' house, there's all these altars for different saints and they're all doing different things, or my grandmother is asking them to do different things. And I think that is what made it so easy for me to transition into paganism, even though I never became like a polytheist or anything like that. And a lot of my paganism is much more nature-centered or druidic in some senses, but it made it easier to kind of then shift that focus onto the natural world and seeing the natural world as this composite of all of these different types of spirits, entities, energies, whatever they might be, that are just kind of commingling with us and around us. And then even circling back to like the queer ancestor part of that, it was so interesting to then go back and find all of like the queer saints. And those are folks that I have incorporated into some of the practice and stuff that I do as a way of kind of healing, I guess, some of that Catholic trauma. Like the folk Catholic approach to stuff is something that just comes naturally to me. It's something that I'm used to. So that is something that I've kind of allowed back into my life. And I was really reticent at first because I was like, well, you know, I'm really wanting to be queer centered or queer affirming, like how is this going to work? But then finding out, like, you know, all of these queer coded saints or these saints or figures from that mythology or cosmology that historically have been read as queer or could be read as queer. My personal favorite, and I actually wear a charm on a necklace, it's a little saint icon of Saint Sebastian, and he's kind of pulling double duty because he is also one of the five plague saints. And so I started wearing this icon of Saint Sebastian at the start of COVID to kind of help ward off, you know, give myself a little bit of magical oomph to, you know, try not to get sick. But also Saint Sebastian is considered a queer saint. And out of all of the saints that could be potentially queer coded or either male identified, female identified, or even some saints that you could theoretically read into them a trans allegory, Saint Sebastian is my favorite because there's nothing about his story that necessarily marks him as a queer saint or a gay saint. The reason he is considered like a patron saint of homosexual men is because in the Renaissance, a bunch of like clearly homosexual painters and sculptors just were so thirsty for Saint Sebastian. And just if you look at how they depicted him, how they painted him, like he was just like a Renaissance era thirst trap. And that's why he was adopted as like this patron saint of gay men. And I just absolutely love that story.
Not me Googling pictures of Saint Sebastian. But oh my God, you're right. I definitely see the thirst trap that you're talking about. His Wikipedia photo, man. I mean, that's a nice rendition. So I want to ask, is there like a list or a book or like, how do you identify queer saints? And then I guess the second part of this question was, how do you identify queer ancestors within your lineage that perhaps did not address that they were or say that they were queer due to whatever reason in their background?
Yeah, great questions. So there is a really great, there's a bunch of books or folks that you can find to kind of explore some of like sexualities in early Christianity and medieval Christianity, that sort of stuff. But I think where I would route people to is Q Spirit. And it's this website. I forgot the name of the woman who runs it, but she's been running it for a long time. And it is a great just resource for either queer identified Christians or folks who some of their magical practices might pull from Christianity, especially folks who might be more into sort of the Western esoteric traditions that are maybe like based out of the early modern grimoires that were very much inspired by and deeply pulling from Christian iconography and things like that. It's just a great resource to kind of see and hear and read the different stories and depictions of a variety of saints across the entire history of Christianity. As far as to the second question about like finding queer ancestors in your lineage and things like that, there are, I think, two approaches that I take to it. And depending on different traditions, I've heard them referred to in different ways. There's red thread and white thread ancestors. There's ancestors of blood and ancestors of milk and honey. But really what it comes down to is ancestors in the sense of the folks who are directly genetically related to you. So, you know, if you're mapping your biological family tree, but then ancestors who are not necessarily related to you, but are your relation to them is your kinship within a specific community. And that community could be something like being, you know, LGBTQ+ identified, but it could also be, so I mentioned that I'm now an ordained cleric through the Sacred Well Congregation. So that's a community that I'm part of now. And so there could be ancestors of folks who, you know, ordained clerics who have come before me and have since passed. It could be through profession. And you see that a lot too, like with some of the saints, if you really dig into that, that different saints might be associated with different professions. And in the same way, some deities might be associated with different professions. So there's different ways to kind of go about that. My uncle on my mom's side, her younger brother, so he's gay, he's still alive. As far as I know, he's the only person blood related to me who is queer of some sort. And my mom's a Cuban refugee. I grew up mostly with her side of the family, and it was very small. It was just her, her parents. My great-grandmother was alive while I was in middle school, and then my uncle, who was born stateside. So me personally, I don't know a lot of my blood-related family, and I've tried to do some of the genealogy stuff, and I've found some interesting stuff from like my dad's side, which is pretty cool. But again, because my mom's side of the family is from Cuba, getting access to those records is pretty hard. Well, it's more than pretty hard. It's pretty much impossible unless you like hire somebody or jump through a bunch of hoops. And so I don't really know a lot about my direct sort of family blood lineage from the part of my family that I feel most closely connected to. So for me, my queer ancestor work, when I went looking for those ancestors, where it was those ancestors of community. And I very much started with, you know, who do I already know? Whose stories have I heard? So, you know, Oscar Wilde, Martha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, folks that I had either heard about through, like, honestly, the first queer identified person that I ever heard about, like, that folks outwardly said, like, yeah, this person was queer, was Oscar Wilde in high school English class. And then as I went to college and got more involved, like came out and wanted to learn more about the queer community, the names you hear a lot more of are folks like I said, Martha B. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, those sorts of folks, because they're, you know, because of Stonewall and the legacies that come out of Stonewall. So a lot of it was just doing the research and learning about the history of my community.
So for those who want to know more about their queer ancestors that they may have a bloodline related to, I know you talked about having difficulties with that, but would you recommend doing something like Ancestry or, I don't know, even 23andMe or something? Well, maybe not 23andMe, but maybe more of Ancestry to see if that's like a good first step, or do you have a different recommendation outside of just like doing the mundane work to try to see if you have queer ancestors that are interested in working with you or that are even in your bloodline?
Yeah. So from the bloodline perspective, I think the best way to start is to kind of, so I also do like I'm a, I guess, amateur researcher, like historical researcher as well. The best thing that I would say to do is before you even kind of go looking for who in your direct lineage might be queer, especially if that's something that your family talks about, is to do the research to understand how queerness was talked about in previous generations. One of the hardest things in doing sort of queer history research is if you are pre-Stonewall or pre-World War II, and even earlier than that, the further back you go, the harder it is to find explicit references to folks identifying as what we would consider queer. And there's two different things that complicate that. One, it's the idea of what queerness is, or how queerness identifies, or how people identify as queer, is culturally contextual. So we ascribe certain behaviors or certain types of relationships as queer now that wouldn't necessarily have really, nobody really would have batted an eye at 150 years ago, 200 years ago. You know, that long ago, it was very common for younger men, like adolescent men, to have these very close, intimate, emotional relationships. And the thought was that, yes, it makes sense that boys become very emotionally, intimately attached to one another, and so do girls, because they're more alike. And that was fine as long as once you became an adult, and I'm talking specifically like in like Western history, like in the Americas, once you became an adult, as long as you then married and, you know, an opposite sex partner and had kids, like that was fine. But those types of like adolescent, emotionally close, intimate relationships are something that now we would code as queer, for better or for worse, like whether it's true or not. And so trying not to be anachronistic about how you look at the folks that came before us and kind of figure out, you know, like, oh yeah, that person was clearly like, they were, you know, they were clearly gay, and not falling into like the Tumblr meme of like, oh my God, they were roommates. But
and they were roommates. Or two dudes chilling in a hot tub
five feet apart because they're not gay. But same. But so it's very easy to look back at some things and go like, ah, yes, I found a queer ancestor, when without having the cultural context of realizing, no, that was totally acceptable for them at the time. Not to say that they weren't queer, but that we can't use modern day sort of behavior or social markers or expectations or benchmarks to judge that. And also the language is totally different. The word homosexual didn't exist until the late 19th century. So you have to be aware of the language that gets used during like its time, during its generation. Like in the early 20th century, somebody being referred to as a confirmed bachelor, like that could oftentimes be code for like, we know that he is never going to marry a woman for various reasons that we're not going to say. And then the further back you go, the harder it is to find references to queerness that are not tied to, especially post late 19th century, when the word homosexual gets introduced, that threw up like the 1970s. It's hard not to find references to queerness that aren't medicalized, because it was considered to be a degenerate medical condition. But even before, what was that?
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, in the DSM,
yeah,
you know, if you look at some mental institutions, I mean, people were institutionalized for being gay or being found out that they were gay.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrific. And like that stuff still happens. And we just, you know, and not just like in other countries, but like sometimes, you know, that sort of ostracization still happens. But the further back you go, the harder it is, like you will really only find references in the context of religion or the legal system. And so if you did have somebody who in your blood lineage who was queer, but they were never caught and tried, and there's not like a record of a trial or an arrest or something like that, you will probably never know, because they took that shit to their grave. And unfortunately too, if you let's say they were folks who exchange letters, maybe they did have a partner for a long time and they exchanged letters. Unfortunately, sometimes when they passed, family would destroy those letters or destroy that evidence because it was so shameful that they didn't want it to get out. So it, from the blood lineage perspective of looking for queer ancestors, you have to be aware of all of those sorts of social obstacles that you're going to encounter, especially if you have family that doesn't necessarily want to talk about it.
I could definitely agree with, or I can relate with that, where I've had, it wasn't until very recently, and I'm in my early 30s, that my one of my family members disclosed in a shameful tone on her end some history about something my grandmother had done, a medical procedure she used to do to help women. And I thought it was the coolest thing when I found that out. But my mother had so much shame and guilt because she is very Catholic and very religious. And I think it's something she would have potentially taken to her grave. But I'm very glad she told me. So I wouldn't be surprised if there, maybe not even for myself, but just like in general, if many people had queer ancestors in their lineage, that even if there wasn't any evidence, like letters or anything, that it might just be like, oh, we don't talk about that. And, or they might not even tell their downline of their children or anything about that, just to keep it secret and hidden away, which is awful.
Yeah. And I've had conversations with folks who are like, well, you know, you can look for like who in the family tree, like didn't have kids. Maybe that's an indicator. And, you know, I pointed out to them, I was like, there are plenty of, I mean, you don't have to go that far back. I mean, even today, there are plenty of folks who don't come out to themselves even until later in life, after they've married, after they've had kids. And then we can also get into the fact that, you know, that is very much in the realm of sort of like bi erasure, pan erasure, where it's like, okay, yeah, maybe they did end up with an opposite sex partner and have kids, but that doesn't make them any less queer if that is something that they would have identified as. So it can get really tricky unless you have like primary source documents that say, like, from that person who say like, yup, like, this is who I was into, this is the stuff that I did, and it provides the social context of, because also one of the things about queerness and one of the things I love about being queer and queerness in general is that it also shifts with what the social context is. And it means, and it usually is indicative of something that's like on the fringes or on the margins, and something that is looking at social order, social structures, and saying, yeah, these don't necessarily work, and I don't know why we have them. So unless you find something that's like primary source that you can say, yeah, for sure it was this, then that's really hard. Now, from a magical practice perspective, when I am doing queer ancestor work and I am invoking queer ancestors or inviting them into sacred space with me, either in a personal practice, personal ritual, or if I'm leading some sort of community ritual or workshop, then I always make sure to have a line that invites our queer ancestors that are unknown or that could not be out in their time or could not express themselves in their time, just to leave that door open for, you know, I don't necessarily have to be able to find you on ancestry.com. You're still welcome in this space, even if I'm never going to know your name or I'm never going to be able to really unearth your history.
There is something that Jack Chenek wrote in Queen of All Witcheries with one of his rituals. And I want to say it was like one of the very first ones in the book, where it involved working with your matriarchal lineage and saying something like, my name is so-and-so, daughter of so-and-so, granddaughter of so-and-so. And you keep going back and back and back until you get to a particular generation. I think it was like the sixth generation. But there was a suggestion in there where if you didn't know their name, there was like something he said you could do. I think it was something like, oh, the daughter or the great or great granddaughter of the mother of the granddaughter. Like it was something like repeating to get to their name. And so I think that's interesting that you bring up where if you don't know your queer ancestor's name, still like kind of putting a line out there for them to connect with them. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And then like also, so the example you just gave reminded me also to mention like the importance, especially when it comes to queerness and queer identity, that the importance of the concept of found family or chosen family, because for some folks, their relationship to their biological family is not a healthy one or a safe one, or one that doesn't come with a certain amount of trauma. And so, and we're kind of now branching out to like that other sort of group of ancestors, right? So like, they're not necessarily blood related to you, but they're ancestors of community. But I think specifically within the queer context, you also have that middle ground too, where I think chosen family, and for whatever reason, actually, not for whatever reason, I know why, it's because yesterday while driving home, I was listening to the soundtrack from To Wong Fu. But I was thinking about drag families, drag houses, and how like, you know, in a particular drag house, you have like the mother and then like her daughters and that relationship. And when you were explaining, walking through that particular ritual format, it made me think of a way that you know, witches who are also drag performers could like really center their drag ancestors by still using that same formula of, you know, like I'm so-and-so daughter of whoever your drag mother is, and then their drag mother and their drag mother and their drag mother. So there's lots of interesting ways to connect and to use existing sort of formula or ritual formats or practices that you can then queer and use them to be able to connect to queer ancestors. I think that's one of the things that sometimes folks feel challenged by, is they think that in order to do stuff that is queer affirming or LGBTQ plus affirming, you kind of have to reinvent the wheel. And really, again, coming to like what I think queerness is, it's like, no, we're not reinventing the wheel. We're just saying like, well, you could use the wheel in a different way.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that analogy about like using the wheel in a different way. And also, of course, the drag, the drag example. So there is one thing that you said, I want to back up a little bit. And it was just this term that you used. And for those who are not familiar with it, you talked about white thread, red thread ancestors. Could you talk what that means?
Yeah, for sure. So it's not necessarily phrases or terminology that I use in my personal practice, but I've heard in different groups or different settings that folks using things, like I said, like red thread or white thread or ancestors of blood, ancestors of milk and honey. The red thread, white thread is that the red thread are, again, like red being indicative of blood. Those are the ancestors that you are directly related to. You have some sort of blood relation, genetic relation to them. The white thread ancestors are the ones that are your ancestors of community. So there's something other than blood. There's something other than that red thread that ties you together or weaves you all into a sense of community. And it could be a shared social identity. It could be a shared profession. There's the sort of Tumblr trash of me that's just like, oh, like it'll be really interesting to see like the super Hulock fandom through the lens of like ancestor veneration or something. So just that idea of community is that white thread that connects you to all of those people that came before you.
Awesome. Thank you for explaining that. Okay. So there was something that you had said earlier, and this is really backing up. This is something you said at the very beginning that I wanted to touch upon. And you had talked about having a role in the church growing up. And I just wanted to briefly discuss this because it's been astounding to me the amount of witches that I have met who have also had some sort of role in their church when they were growing up, whether that was being an altar boy or something of the sorts. And I just think it's interesting that a lot of witches were part of that. And I think that perhaps were seeking spirituality, but then found that particular one of whatever their background might have been, whether it was Catholicism or being Baptist or something, that wasn't the fit. So I just thought it was funny when you were talking about that, because I was like, wow, you were like there's been so heap on a list that I've heard that have had that similar experience of working in the church in some capacity as a kid. Working is a strong word, but I hope you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think I would classify it as working. So yeah, I was an altar server. So I did not go to a Catholic school. So because I didn't go to a Catholic school, that meant that I had to go to catechism classes once a week after school. So on Wednesdays, I was in what's called CCD. And I actually enjoyed it. I think for me, the reason why I enjoyed it is because when I was living in Miami and we were growing up until like the very last summer we lived there, we didn't really have like a formal church. So we met in a community center that was kind of retrofitted to be a church. But because it was originally a community center, like that's the vibe, like that was the spirit of the place. And our priest was actually somebody that my dad had gone to high school with. So there was a lot of my first exposure to the church, in addition to being from that Catholic background or that Cuban Catholic background, was very much a sense of a place of community. And I was an altar server because my dad was an altar server. And so they're like, you're going to continue the tradition. And I didn't mind it. Like, I really enjoyed it. And I liked feeling like I was part of something that was an anchor of the community. And there was a sort of spiritual fulfillment. I don't think how old was I at then? Like 7, 8, 9, something like that. So I don't know that I would have had like the vocabulary to talk about it, but there was definitely this sense of spiritual fulfillment in working with in that capacity. And actually, there was a good stretch of time, like I think fourth and fifth grade, when I told my parents, I was like, hey, I think I actually want to be a priest when I grow up. And once we moved out of Miami, we moved to sort of like, we moved to the swamps pretty much. It's been since been developed. But the church community that we went to then was a very different one. It was a very white church, very homogenous church, much more conservative. And that's when I started to become more disillusioned with it, because it was the sort of church where everybody pretended to get along for an hour inside the church. But like as soon as after church, in the parking lot, everyone's trying to get out and like honking at each other, cutting each other off in the parking lot. So I just became very disillusioned with it. And then as I started to understand my own identity and my own sexuality, that just kind of further caused a schism. And I also remember, I think for me, like the final like nail in that coffin was when my first dog died. And I remember again, I wasn't in a Catholic school, so I had to go weekly to CCD. The CCD church leader saying, I think somebody had said something along the lines of just like, oh, well, you know, at least you see your dog in heaven. And they're like, well, actually, God only gave human souls. So no, they don't, you know, dogs don't go to heaven. And for me, I think that was the final thing where I was like, well, I don't know that I can buy into this anymore, because absolutely, you know, I think at the time I was like, my dog definitely had a soul. Like, you know, like, and I realized that was sort of the awakening of sort of like the animism in me, and being like, no, I definitely think all these things around us are ensouled or have some sort of divinity in them. And I'm not really buying what you're selling anymore. But yeah. And I think I had to go through a process of reckoning and understanding my own sexuality before I could get back to being able to find a spirituality or even think about reconnecting with something that would be spiritually fulfilling for me. Because you said Catholic trauma at the beginning. And I think for me, my Catholic trauma was the losing something that I didn't realize at the time was that my spirituality was such a core component of what kept me grounded. And there was many years as a teen where I felt like I had to choose one or the other. And I was desperately trying to choose not being gay. And eventually realizing, no, like, this is who I am and I'm not going to run away from it, made me feel like I had to put down spirituality. And it took a lot of exploring what being gay meant to me, figuring out who I am as a gay man, and coming, working through a lot of internalized homophobia and trauma around homophobia before I was even in a place to then be like, okay, let me reconnect. In that interim period, I did try Wicca. I did kind of a spiritual walkabout, and I found things that worked for me, especially through my sort of brief foray into Wicca, because in the late 90s, that was really all that was available was books about Wicca. That was a great way for me to figure out how to center and ground myself in relation to a nature-based and earth-based spirituality, which is still very much an important part of my spirituality. But, you know, I was still having problems with, at the time, all of the covens I was exposed to, or the community that I had access to was very much still in this binary, this male-female binary, this polarity. And I'm not trying to say that that's incorrect or the wrong way to do things, but it was just, while I was trying to figure out what it meant for me to be a gay man, it wasn't a good space for me to be in about talking about things like the great right and like male and female coupling. I was like, I'm not interested in this in my personal life. It took me a long time to realize that I don't want to be in a space where that is centered right now.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's totally fair. And I want to say, I'm glad that you were able to find your way into your truth. And I know there's a lot of people who grow up in these different backgrounds, like Catholicism, especially those who, like you and myself, grew up with Hispanic Catholicism, which is a whole different beast, who sometimes never feel comfortable enough to come out and really just be who they are. So applause to you for that, because I'm sure I have some ancestors down, if I look far enough, who never felt comfortable enough or able to come out. And that's really hard to think about sometimes.
Yeah, thanks. And I think that ultimately it's interesting how things kind of circle back, because now I find myself like an ordained pagan cleric, and my focus really is on queer affirming spirituality or queer centered spirituality. And I engage with a lot of pagan groups in my area, presents at different conferences on queer affirming spirituality, queer ancestor work, connecting with queer ancestors. And I have a lot of conversations with pagan leaders of different covens or traditions or paths that are very much interested in trying to figure out how to make their spaces more accessible to queer identified folks. And but are also trying to find that balance of reckoning of like, well, this is what our tradition says, or I'm trying to maintain this, but I want these folks to be able to be in community with us. And what does that look like? And I'm really glad that those conversations are happening. And I feel very fortunate to have the type of experience that I do, both just personal experience, but then also professional experience, and then also trained sort of spiritual experience, to be able to do what I can to make those spaces more affirming or welcoming for queer identified folks.
I think it's funny that you had talked about earlier how you told your dad, I believe you said, that you wanted to be a priest when you grew up, and then found your way kind of getting involved in that, but not with Catholicism, with a different type of spirituality. And the reason I think I find that funny is because when my mom was growing up, she wanted to be a nun very badly, a Catholic nun. And so I sometimes think it's funny that her daughter grew up to be a high priestess of her own tradition for Wicca, and definitely not Catholicism. So it's just kind of funny, like, how that ends up happening.
Yeah, no, I love that. And yeah, and it's really interesting too, because like, kind of touching on the queer ancestor veneration part too, a lot of, I mentioned before, like, you know, not having to reinvent the wheel, just like, how can you use the wheel differently? And so I some of the workshops or ritual spaces that I'll hold, I think some folks will show up with this, I think, expectation of something that is really ornate. And I, at my heart, I'm a folk witch. Like, that's my thing. Like, I no shade to the ceremonial witches or anything like that. I love it. I love participating in them occasionally. One, I have horrible ADHD, so I can't be trusted to run something like that. And two, like, I really just the way I grew up and the things that speak to me are really that more folksy thing. So like, a lot of the queer ancestor workshops that I run, there's one that I do consistently every Pride month before a local Pride, is a queer ancestor talisman workshop. And it really is just an arts and crafts night. Like, I feel like I'm a kindergarten teacher who rolls in with like the cart full of stuff. I'm just like, here's some boxes of stuff. We're going to talk about queer ancestors. We're going to create a queer ancestor community altar. I'm going to lead a guided journey so that you can kind of connect with queer ancestors and see how they inspire you to make this fun little trinket that then you can take to Pride the next day to kind of charge and then do what you want. Like, maybe it's something you put on your altar, maybe it's something you hang in your car. And so I think for me, part of what I try to center, especially in like the queer affirming spirituality, but also the queer ancestor work, is just trying to make it as accessible as possible and also as fun as possible. Because I think too often when you, I think there's two intersecting things here. I think when you talk about ancestors, you're clearly talking about the dead. And I think in too many capacities or too many traditions, we're a little bit too somber about the dead. And then when you're talking about queer history, it's hard to talk about queer history or really any marginalized history in the Americas without there being a fair bit of death. And so I think for me, the way that I try to combat that is to create these spaces where it's like, yeah, we're gonna connect with this history, we're gonna connect with this community, but we don't have to be somber or silent about it. Like, we can be celebratory. We can have fun. I have like a queer ancestor playlist that I play during these workshops, and it's all stuff like Madonna and Cher and Scissor Sisters and stuff like that. And it's like, no, we're gonna have fun. We're gonna celebrate, because celebration can still be a way of remembering and honoring the dead. It doesn't have to be sort of a drab, tear-filled, silent experience.
So I was going to ask you, you touched upon doing this, and then you also talked about making things with the queer ancestors, like the talismans. But yeah, how do you navigate these discussions about queer identity and spirituality within the broader witchcraft communities?
Yeah, so I will say, I feel like over the last 20 or so years, there's been a lot of growth. I think as a lot of queer folks have moved away from sort of mainstream religious traditions, they have moved away in a sense where they said, this space doesn't work for me, but I am still a spiritual being, I'm still a spiritual person. And they have found other ways to have that sort of transcendent experience with the divine. So I think from that perspective, I think it's just a numbers game of more queer folks have said, this is not a part of myself that I want to give up. And so either we have created our own spaces like the Radical Fairies, or we have shown up in spaces and our presence has necessitated the conversation of, okay, how are we going to include you in these spaces? And I think sometimes, especially early on, the conversation was more, we can only include you in these spaces if you do X. And some folks chose not to and then went and kind of started their own thing. And then some folks pushed back or said, well, explain why. And it started that that dialogue. I also think from the sort of witchcraft perspective and kind of really pulling from this idea of sort of like folk witchcraft, things like that. Ultimately, for me personally, I think witchcraft is 100% political. And if you look at things like from the Aredia Gospel of the Witches and all that, like if you look at that, like clearly she's teaching witchcraft, teaching poisoning as a way for folks to liberate themselves from their oppressors. And so there's this long through line of folk charms, folk prayers, things that folks have done that I think no matter how you look at it can be construed as witchcraft that is meant to provide protection or to bring prosperity or to bring love. And I think within the queer community or the history of the queer community, especially, you know, post Stonewall being a little bit more visible, these are all things that the queer community on the margins has had to contend with of how do we keep ourselves safe? How do we keep ourselves fed? How do we afford rent? How do we find love? Even if that love might be like, oh my God, I really wish that straight guy would like look at me. And I think for me, an example that's really coming up right now is this perfect intersection of sort of folk Catholicism. And part of folk Catholicism is all of these unsanctioned saints. And one that I work with a lot is Santa Muerte. And she is she's a number of things, but one of the things that she is within the Latin American Hispanic sort of milieu, she is considered a protector of the LGBT plus community. You know, I think a lot of folks associate her with like violence and drugs and the cartels, and that's very much a white Western American sort of media depiction. Not to say that she's not involved with that, but she also is somebody, she's a figure, she's a spirit that the Latinx LGBT plus community turns to a lot for protection, prosperity, and yeah, I just think that has always been such a part of witchcraft of, you know, what are the things that I can do to maybe tilt the scales a little bit more in my favor, that it just makes sense that queer folks have also been doing that the whole time.
I feel like there's so much we could discuss in terms of witchcraft being political that it involves an entirely new episode just on that topic. But just to touch on this, I guess this is like a broad question, but what advice would you offer to people who are interested in exploring this intersection of witchcraft and politics, especially within the context of a queer identity?
Yeah. So there are two really great books that I would recommend. They both came out around the same time and they're both called Queer Magic. So it makes it a little bit confusing, but one of them is by Tomas Prower, and he is another gay identified witch pagan. And that book is sort of a look at queer magic, queer mythology from around the world. And then there's another one that's an edited anthology called Queer Magic, Power Beyond Boundaries. And it's edited by Lee Harrington and Ty Phoenix Calliston. And that one is a bunch of sigils or essays or rituals or reflections from a number of different queer trans identified folks from a variety of backgrounds of magical traditions and pagan backgrounds. I think those two books are really great to kind of get your feet wet and get an understanding of what that looks like, especially the anthology one, if you want to really see the intersection between queerness, magic, and politics.
Awesome. And it is confusing that they have the same title, but I mean, I guess as long as you remember one title, you remember them both.
Yeah, like it's funny. I mean, they're from different publishing houses, but it's funny that managed to happen.
Cool. all right. So kind of just to wrap this up, going back to queer ancestors. So what advice would you give to somebody who wants to start incorporating and honoring their queer ancestors within their witchcraft practice? Like, is there a particular ritual they could do, an offering they could do? I know we talked about the research, the mundane research aspect side of things, but yeah, what would you recommend?
So my biggest thing when it comes to queer ancestor stuff, especially for folks who want to start, is this notion, and I'm sure folks have heard this phrase a bunch, but it's the "that which is remembered lives." So I would really recommend finding a way. So I have personally have like a queer ancestor shrine in my backyard, but I would personally find a way to incorporate some sort of physical marker, either on your altar, if that's something you feel comfortable with, or if not on your altar, then just somewhere else that is something that you see pretty routinely. And it could be something very simple. It could be just like a little tea light with a pride flag next to it, or if something more ornate, if that's really what you want. But I think having that physical thing that brings queer ancestors to the front of your mind, and also in so doing kind of helps lend your energy to them, or kind of charge that item or that space, I think is a great place to start. And coupling that with doing that research, or just kind of figuring out, you know, even if it's just the ancestors of community, and just learning more about who are local queer folks in your area, who are the queer movers and shakers in your area, or more, from a more global context. I think that's how I would recommend people start. Just have something that makes you remember them, that you see every day.
I love that. And I think that's totally reasonable to be able to have something like a tiny tea light. I think that's not a big ask. I think it would be interesting for those who are in the broom closet, or have to hide their practice for some reason. Perhaps they live with people or family that's not so accepting of their witchcraft practice, what they could possibly do. But I don't think anybody's really going to question it if you have multicolored rainbow candles, because I don't know, they're candles.
I mean, or if you're in like a Catholic household or something like that, you know, I talked about Saint Sebastian. Just say like, hey, I really want to get a Saint Sebastian statue or saint candle or something, and you know, and folks generally don't ask too many questions. Most, even Catholic folks, don't even realize like the queer saints or things like that. So that's that is one way that historically a lot of queer Catholic folks have actually flown under the radar, is finding those saints and incorporating them into their what they wear, like their jewelry or their iconography in their home, because it you know, it's not going to draw suspicion, because it's a Catholic saint. Why would anybody think that is somehow queer?
I love that. It's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Ron, this has been such an awesome conversation with you. And like I said, I think we could have just kept going on and on, especially about witchcraft being political. That's a whole other topic that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But before we wrap up officially, I wanted to ask if you had any, well, two things. One, if you have any final thoughts on queer ancestors. Let me start with that.
Yeah. So I think final thoughts on queer ancestors is just, especially right now. So we're recording this in March of 2024, and right now is a really scary sociopolitical moment for the queer community. Between the book bans, all of the stuff that's going on, there is a really concerted effort to once again sort of erase the fact that we exist. And one, remembering our queer ancestors and kind of shouting their stories from the rooftop is a way to show that we've always been here. And two, making sure that one day I will be a queer ancestor, and making sure that my story is something that can't get erased, making sure that the story of my queer community in the DMV area, my queer community across the world now, is preserved and something that our queer descendants can look at and talk about, is also vital in kind of continuing this torch of queer ancestry.
I love that. And I want to add a comment to that that is not nearly as eloquent as you put that, but for those wondering, the DMV, he does not mean the Department of Motor Vehicles. Oh. He's talking about DC, Maryland, Virginia.
Yeah, I've been here long enough that I just assume that's what everybody knows.
Yeah, no. I use the DMV terminology too, and I've had my out of area friends be like, what are you doing at the Department of Motor Vehicles? I'm like, oh, never mind. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut off such an eloquently stated comment with my, by the way, he's not talking about that. Oh gosh, yes, but no, that was great. I did want to ask then one final question, and that is if you could give a piece of advice to a beginner starting out in the craft, doesn't have to be related to anything that we spoke to today, what would you say to them?
Experiment. Don't, if you're anything like me, it's going to be real easy for you to get hung up on making sure that you are following everything to the letter, to whatever. And if you get too in your head about that, then you are 100% not in the moment. You're 100% not in the ritual. You're not in sacred space. So don't be afraid to experiment, to kind of get what you want to get across, and use, you know, your books, whatever, as sort of guideposts. But the point is to have that, to cast that spell, to have that magic happen, to have that transcendent experience with the divine, not necessarily to follow every step perfectly.
I love that. That's pretty sound advice. Well, thank you, Ron, so, so much for coming on. How can people find you?
Yeah, so the easiest way is on my website, so www.whiterosewitching.com. That has links to all of my socials. I'm most active on Instagram. I also have Facebook because I'm an elder millennial, so I still post there. And I am moving more to Threads. The only reason I'm still kind of tangentially on Twitter is because if I deleted that account, somebody could steal that name. And if you don't use your account regularly, then they will auto delete it. So I'm not too involved on there. And then I also have a monthly newsletter you can sign up for on the website. It's I try to only send it out once a month. I don't want to clog people's inboxes, and it's at the end of the month, so it's just a roundup of blog posts, announcements, things like that. And one of the things on the blog I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned this, is I do queer ancestor spotlights. I try to do them once a month. Sometimes life gets in the way, but the queer ancestor spotlights sometimes highlight folks that we already know about. I try to find folks and stories that we don't know about necessarily, and it links to a queer ancestor map that I use, GIS system, so that you can visually see where all these stories are coming from, because I'm really trying to make it a sort of a global storytelling, which is part of my personal practice and how I venerate queer ancestors.
Awesome. That's super cool. And I will also put a link in the bio for your website too, where people can connect with you. And if anybody wants to find me, you can find me on Facebook at Seeking Witchcraft Podcast, on Instagram at Seeking Witchcraft. Like Ron said, I have Twitter. It's at Seek Witchcraft. I don't really use it that often. And then I also have a personal Instagram if anybody's interested. It's mostly just me working out at the gym, but it's Spells and Kettlebells. And finally, if anybody is interested in supporting the show, you could do so on patreon.com/seekingwitchcraft. Well, with that said, thank you again, Ron, so much for coming on to talk about this. This was such a fascinating conversation. Like, I really enjoyed this.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you so much for having me. And if you, at any point in the future, want to just rant about politics and witchcraft, I am always happy to do that.
Amazing. I'm definitely going to take you up on that. I'll message you after this for sure about that. But thank you to everyone who listened, and enjoy the rest of your day or night or whenever you're listening to this. Bye.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.